Well, it's called I Believe, When What You Believe Matters, with Eldon Taylor. Much more to talk with him about. Next hour, we'll take phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, incredible analogies there when you talk about things like the checkerboard. You look at it, it's there, but the eyes just don't see it. And I bet that's the way in real life too, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. You know, our perception forms our reality. The research shows us, well, you can take the Pygmalion factor as a case in point. Researchers can take a student, give the student to the teacher, a student who is learning disabled, learning impaired, explain to a teacher, a new teacher, that this student is gifted. And at year's end, the child will be gifted. The expectation of the teacher somehow makes huge improvements in the student. There are lots of stories. Candace Pert tells the story of conquistadors and Montezuma. And as far as Candace Pert's research, Candace Pert of Stanford University, is concerned, she explains that whole phenomena as the Aztec Indians had never seen anything like the ships that sailed in. What they saw were conquistadors, these gods with gold helmets walking on water. And, of course, they had a prophecy having to do with the gods coming back. So they just naturally assumed they were the gods. And, well, history bears the rest of that story. You know, there's a little island in the Pacific. And the story about In John We Trust, you know. And the bottom line to that goes this way. A pilot landed there back during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he brought in some supplies, and other pilots were landing there bringing in supplies. And to the natives, this was a real boon. They were seeing things that they'd never thought of or heard of, ranging from candy bars to, you know, cup of coffee. Well, When the war ended, this little tropical island, the pilots exited. They left. And John, the first pilot to land, of course, that's how all of the natives knew him. He was a drill sergeant. He'd raised a flag on a pole in a tall tree, and he built this little hut, and the hut served as kind of a tower to guide the planes in, et cetera. Well, when they all left, the islanders weren't sure what to do, and of course John had told them, you know, we'll be back. So to this day, on this little island, and anyone can Google this again, just In John We Trust, on this little island, what they do is every day they carry out a similar ceremony where they make certain that the chair inside the hut is sitting right, that the antenna is up, that the flag is there, that the stuffed person that they have, this little dummy that they put in the chair, that his hat is on correct, that he is seeing, that the airfield is clean and neat and raked. They go through the process of replicating as perfectly as they can what it was like when John was landing. Now, generations have changed, and some of these people that are doing this now, they're not really even sure why they're doing it, just that by doing it, they know John will return. They just have to get it right. They just have to get the circumstances exactly as it was. That's how blinded we can become by our expectations, our perceptions. We don't have to be, you know, tropical islanders to discover that in many ways we have been programmed. You know, we come into the world and we're innocent. And for all intent and purposes, we're not just innocent. We're ambitious, and we're exploring, and we vocalize ourselves when we want something. And, you know, we may even pick something out of our diaper and taste it. That's how exploring we are, right? And then, you know, someone comes along and they say, you know, you shouldn't do that. You know, oh, Johnny, don't show your anger. You know, anger is not a good thing to do. And Johnny, don't cry. You know, men, boys, they don't cry. And Johnny, well, what we're doing is we're hiding our emotions. We're hiding part of ourselves in order to be accepted by the herd. And we are, after all, herd animals, and we all seek to be accepted to avoid rejection, to maximize our pleasure, minimize our pain, if you will. And so we begin to hide these feelings that we have, this way of expressing that meets with disdain or disapproval from the people around us. And then we get this whole no-don't stuff that you and I have talked about before. You're not old enough. You're not smart enough. You're too stupid. You'll never amount to anything. You're fat. You're skinny. All of this stuff that our peers and other students and even our parents, best intended parents, can lay on us. And we have no rite of passage, so we don't leave it behind at some point. We just kind of, as Robert Bly says, we just start putting it in this imaginary bag behind us. And pretty quick, that bag becomes a long bag. And we drag this long bag with us everywhere that we go. Well, we are systematically alienating ourselves from who we ultimately really are. We are hiding ourselves away. And as we hide ourselves away, this condition of self-alienation becomes more acute. Then we find ourselves doing things we say we would never do, saying things and wondering why we said that, acting out a life that we know is far less than what we want in our life, and I guarantee you is also far less than what you deserve. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you in relation to that, you and I both know about the law of attraction. Yeah. We're strong believers on this, but tell me, as we talk about, I believe, this is an important facet, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I qualify some there, George. There are people out there, and I'll leave them nameless. One in particular, comes to my mind because, at any rate, that essentially says, if anything happens in your life, everything that happens in your life, it happens because you've created it, you've caused it, you've thought it into being. If you have negativity there, it's in negative thoughts that are attracting it. Now, when somebody gets that far to the extreme, I object. A 14-year-old girl in Pakistan sold to a man to be a bride.
Crazy.
Displeases him. Her nose is cut off. Her ears are cut off. She's discarded to the stable after a beating. She crawls home to her father, who kicks her off the step, literally with his foot. It takes women to women to pick her up to save her life and to find surgeons in America to rebuild her face. And this was a story all over the news. So. The listening audience ought to relate to this. Someone that tells me this 14-year-old girl attracted that because she was thinking that, they need an institution. That's my attitude. We do definitely attract from what we believe, but there is a limit to that. One of the things that I discuss in the book, I believe, is exactly this issue. You can take a scenario. This is a scenario I am actually familiar with. We're in a community of very forward-thinking people that have all read The Secret. We have a contest, and it happens to be an athletic contest among young people at the high school. And it's got quite a nice prize. And there are several students that are competing for this. And most of these students are familiar with The Secret. They go through all the motions of making it happen. I mean, they create their vision board. They visualize it. They see themselves accepting the reward. They go through the whole process. They have it down perfectly. But on the day of the competition, the person that wins didn't use The Secret. He just happened to have natural athletic ability. Well, let's imagine that you had everybody deciding we're just going to use The Secret to attract the lotto. We're all going to win it tonight. What would we do? Would we be dividing it up? I mean, there comes a point where you have to understand that what's missing for many, when it comes to employing the tools that are inherent to the power of your mind is action. You must have an actionable plan that accompanies this whole process. You can't just, you know, take a supine position on your sofa, kick on your daytime or evening TV,
and
imagine that it's going to happen and have it happen.
Or just believe in it, right?
That's well. Now, there's a very definite difference between wishful thinking and true belief. Yeah, I illustrate this in seminars this way. I ask people, in fact, we can use this example to illustrate dissonance as well. I ask people, how many of you here would like to earn $1 million? And every hand goes up. They say, okay, now look, in order to earn $1 million, you're going to have a millionaire mentality. That means, you know, you're going to have to realize we're talking about earning $1 million, not winning a lotto. What you're going to have to do is maybe go at risk. You may have to borrow some money. You may have to create a business. You're going to do something different than what you're doing in order to do that. You're going to have the mentality of a Bill Gates. You're going to have to know that you can do this because that's what's going to underlie your success, your conviction that you can do it. So I want you to say to yourself, this year I'm going to earn $1 million, and I want you to say it, yes, just as sincerely as you can, just as genuinely as you can. Say it to yourself, fully supporting and believing it. And it takes but a second before people begin to get, you know, that back talk from their stream of consciousness that says things to them like, sure, what are you going to do, rob a bank?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what kind of nonsense is this? I've heard this before.
Well, when you start putting negativity, Eldon, into the I believe system, that hurts it. That negates it, doesn't it?
It does. It absolutely does. And that stream of consciousness is a great mirror on it. But, you know, people do that. Often they do that unknowingly. And again, I spell all this out in the book. But here, look, let's just stay with the millionaire story for a second, George. I can step away from that story maybe an hour, not even that much, 30, 40 minutes in a lecture, and begin to reframe the context to discuss, you know, changes in our society and, of course, the national debt and the way the political scene looks. And, oh, gosh, you know all about those Wall Streeters and those bankers and those fat cats, don't you? I mean, we should tax them more, shouldn't we? We should. And these same people that said they wanted to be the fat cat, be the millionaire, yeah, we need to tax them more. We need to penalize them, you know. And in there is a dissonance. They don't realize that there's a dissonance. You're saying, I want to be what it is that I dislike. I want to be that which I want to punish. I want to be successful so you can punish me? That makes no sense at all.
No, it doesn't. It does not. Look, you have a lot of takes on integrity. How does integrity fit into this?
Well, you know, we touched on that a little bit in the get-go. When I brought up how we're wired, the fact is, you know, research has shown us, well, the most recent that I have seen, the researchers designed a protocol whereby strangers were introduced to each other to have a conversation for roughly 10 minutes. And there were more than two, there'd be four or five people in a group having this conversation. The average person lied three times in 10 minutes.
Now, lied?
Lied. You know, they made up stories. They exaggerated. They lied three times in 10 minutes. Now, I've seen research that suggests that we lie three times an hour. But this was three times in a 10-minute period. So the fact of the matter is human beings go through life lying. And unless you're really paying attention, unless you decide that you're not going to, it seems to be, you know, the way it is. Now, let me pause here for a second, because what we're talking about is, you know, we're talking about the kind of self-serving lie that someone might come up with. They might exaggerate their employment, or exaggerate their income, or exaggerate those kinds of lies. We're talking about those kinds of lies as well as the, you know, salacious lies. What we're not talking about is mom and dad were in an automobile accident, and a hypothetical, will be this never happens, but you know, dad's killed, mom's in the hospital, you arrive, the doctor says, whatever you do, don't tell mom your dad's dead, first thing mom asks is, how's dad? Well, obviously you're going to lie, if you will, in that circumstance, but you're doing that to aid another person, not for these selfish motives. And the body knows the difference. So the body punishes or rewards you according to that. Okay, integrity then comes down to this. You know, I used to say in the lie detection business before, you know, we'd start an examination, you're here to tell me the truth today, right? I mean, you're not one of these guys that's going to come in here and lie to me, right? I mean, you do understand that the truth is 100%. It doesn't know portions. I mean, a partial lie, that's kind of like what? Having a wife that's 99% faithful? Is that faithful? You see? So what I'm talking about here is bringing a level of integrity to yourself that I think of this way. John Huntsman tells a story. He sold his business, $57 million. And he, you know, sold it, closed it on a handshake. The buyer of the business put his attorneys on it. It took several months before they had the paperwork. By the time it came time to close, the business value had doubled. Huntsman went to the closing table. The buyer anticipated a problem and said to him, you know, John, let me, you know, work out something here. We've already announced that we're buying your company. I know the company's worth a lot more now. What can we come up with? And Huntsman said to him, you know, I shook hands with you. I gave you my word. Our deal is at $57 million.
That doesn't happen a lot, does it?
No, that takes real integrity. But if you haven't got that, what have you got? I mean, if you can't look yourself in the mirror and feel that you're an honest human being, you do your very best, what do you have?
Now, the other guy should have said, you know what? You've just shown me something I never expected from anybody. I'm giving you $75
million. Yeah, I agree with you. And you and I would have done that.
Yeah.
You know, that's a fact. And that would have been an act on the other side of integrity. But, you know, I remember a song when I was a boy, well, a young man. I think Henson Cargill sang the song, and it was, you know, Skip a Rope. Isn't it kind of funny what the children say? That was the lyrics to it. You know, cheat on your taxes, keep the golden rule. A lot of people go through life that way, you know. You know, doing to others as you would have others doing to you. I guess the government is not others, so we'll just lie a little bit on the taxes. I mean, after all, everybody does, don't they? I mean, and it's very easy for us to rationalize, well, everybody else does that. You know, shouldn't we do that? And the bottom line is, in that process, the only person we're really damaging is ourselves.
Is ourselves. That's absolutely. You know, Eldon, as people go through all these tensions and things that are affecting people, does this belief system get shattered?
Well, a solid belief doesn't. Wishful thinking can, but a belief system doesn't. I mean, and of course, one of the things that I point out in the book, not to be a minister, not to tell you what to believe, but there's a very pragmatic function to having a spiritual belief. Centurions, the fastest growing population, the data there shows us that the common denominator they have is not clean living and self-denial. It is a sense of connectedness, a spiritual connectedness, a purpose to life. Sometimes we deal with things in life that without that, I don't know how you do. I mean,
well, let's talk about the spiritual person versus the person that is not when we come right back. Well, earlier, Eldon was mentioning our television show, Beyond Belief. You can watch it 10 days free, and then if you like it, jump on board. It's an exciting program. Plus, you get access to hundreds of incredible videos as well. Simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, click hosts, and the TV icon opens up. And there you have it. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Eldon Taylor. Eldon, spirituality, the difference between those who have it and those who don't. What do you think?
Well, here's what the evidence shows. And, you know, again, first of all, I'm not pandering any religion.
I understand.
Yeah, okay. Because the data shows clearly, it doesn't matter. You could be Sikh, you could be Buddhist, you could be Presbyterian, you could be a Muslim. It matters not. It is this sense of connectedness, this sense that life has a purpose that I'm really addressing here. And when we look at that, we call that spirituality. When we look at that, we see that patients do better in under psychiatric care. They recover much quicker. We see that survivors of tragedies are able to integrate their lives much more readily and deal with the adversity than those that... In fact, I started to say before the break, in years past when I would do counseling, someone that you could see who had lost a loved one, say a father who's lost his son, a young child, very, very difficult to give this person any kind of hope, any kind of reconciliation without calling on the idea that his child still survives, yet in another plane, perhaps, that they have just passed through a door. To deal with people from the standpoint that you're just a meat machine, a part of the Darwinian evolution, adaptation, mutation, even accident, and that is the sum total of it all, that leaves us, obviously, in those circumstances, direly empty, void of any possible way to assuage the drama that we deal with when we have lost a loved one. So the data shows us clearly that, as I started to say before the break, it is this new fast-growing area of our population segment that we think of as the centenarians, people that are 100 years of age and older, who are teaching us that longevity is also connected to this sense of spirituality. There isn't a doubt, if you just look at the hard data, that there is a pragmatic reason to have a spiritual outlook in life. Now, I'm not talking about religion again. I'm addressing the notion that you're accepting that you're more than that meat machine, that there is life after death, that there is meaning and purpose to this life. And if you're accepting that for no other reason than the pragmatic side of it, well, the data shows us you will live longer, you will be healthier, and when you do experience a tragedy or a disease, you will recover faster.
Well, when you recover faster by having all this ability, the spirituality, those who don't have it, though, I mean, are they doomed?
Well, doomed, I don't know. There are some real famous atheists that have gone to their grave as atheists. Sigmund Freud said religion was a sugar-coated religious crutch. John Wisdom said, isn't it nice? It's kind of like having daddy at the end of the hall. Christopher Hitchens, a man that I have great respect for, a very prolific writer who recently passed away, for all intent and purposes, he went also as an atheist. And he said, it mattered not. His point of view would not have made him feel any better or any worse had he been religious as opposed. So maybe, there is something to be said about groups. On average, typically, the people that we find in hospice centers who are completely alienated from any spiritual sense whatsoever are also usually very bitter, very upset about what's happening in their life. And so you discover that they require more pain medication and that they are very difficult to deal with, and that it also seems to make their passing much harder. I have personally interviewed a number of hospice doctors, and they all will tell you to the person. It is that spiritual connection. When it comes time to make that transition, life to whatever exists on the other side, when it comes to make that transition, is the spiritual commitment that makes it easy or difficult for each and all of us. So again, from a purely pragmatic standpoint, unless you, unless maybe you have the discipline of a Christopher Hitchens, I watched that all in just amazement. I think you're going to find it very disappointing to experience life without that element in it. I know Anthony Flew, who used to be the, quote, most famous atheist on the planet, very famous philosopher. Anthony Flew gave us the parable of the garden. The parable goes like this, and it's worth repeating. Two men are coming along through the jungle, and they happen upon a garden. And they look at the garden, and the crops all grow in straight rows. The carrots are in one row, the corn's in one row, the lettuce in a row, the turnips in a row, and so on and so forth. And the one says to the other, ah, there's a gardener somewhere here in the jungle. Look at this perfect garden. And the other says, no, this is just a natural act in nature. You know, if you give nature enough opportunities, it will randomly create almost everything that you can imagine. Oh, well, the first says, that's not true. I know there's a gardener. And the second says, okay, I'll tell you what, let's just hide and wait for the gardener. So they hide, and days pass, and no gardener comes, and yet everything continues to grow in straight rows. No weeds appear. And so our second man says, I told you there's no garden. And the first man says, well, now, wait a minute. Maybe the gardener is, you know, invisible or something. I mean, you know, there has to be a gardener. Look at this garden. So they agree to electrify a fence. Maybe we have an invisible man, you know, and they get dogs, and they put the dogs inside, et cetera. Well, the long and the short of it is, no gardener ever appears. And man two says, okay, I've shown you there is no gardener. And man one says, you know what? I don't care. Maybe you can't see. Maybe you can't touch him. Maybe, I don't know how he does it, but there must be a gardener because look at this garden. Now, obviously, this argument is a reflection on William Paley's philosophical argument about I found a watch. And because all the gears go together, there must be a watchmaker, the so-called teleological argument that many spiritual and religious people call upon to explain, you know, our earth and the nature of the universe and our very being. Well, Anthony Flew, the author of this parable, in his latest book wrote that God exists. And he argues there, based on a lifetime of research for both the pragmatic side of the human condition and for the nature of how all of everything is made, including the human being. You know, we are made in such a way that if you use a low-voltage electronic stimulation directly to certain areas of the brain, you will evoke a deep religious experience. So we are hardwired in ways that gives rise to this religious or spiritual connectedness, this possibility. And if you add it all up and you say, okay, if we're hardwired for this experience and we're hardwired that when we go to the aid of someone in need, you know, our body is bathed with all these good neurochemicals as opposed to getting bathed with all of those that are harmful to the optimal operation of our immune, our endocrine, our ANS. If these things are true, does it suggest that maybe we're made in such a way that we should be reminded of, or that at least if we weren't deliberately made that way, that there is a pragmatic side to living that out because it produces more contentment, a higher sense of self-satisfaction, a sense of fulfillment, and that gives rise to a longer life and healthier living.
When you talk about human flaws and you say a flaw can be good, how is that?
Well, you know, yeah, to me, it's interesting how flaws are. You know, we look at a flaw and we define a flaw how? Well, according to some cultural bias. We'll see someone that we think is overweight, and that's a flaw. We'll see somebody, a young woman that's maybe flat-chested, and we'll think that's a flaw. Maybe they have a large nose, and we will say that's a flaw. Each of us tends to evaluate ourselves against some norm, some standard out there. And that norm or that standard tends to be how we believe we should look. Now, we're sold all this information, all this image information, and this image information has one common denominator. I mean, there's one giant subliminal message in all these ads that come at us, and that's that we're deficient. We're deficient in some way, or we simply wouldn't need the product. You know, our hair isn't as good as it could be. Our face, our complexion, we need this makeup. I mean, the bottom line is you cannot sell someone a life vest unless they think they might drown. So we're bombarded with this on a 24/7 basis. And the net result of that is we have, first of all, just images about what we should be. They're outrageous. They're complete distortions. They're designed to sell us a product, not to describe reality. Secondly, when you look at the individual nature of every human being, it is that difference that many could call a flaw that gives us the ability to distinguish one from another. You know, I have a rather pronounced nose, and I can remember growing up and having, you know, my friends say, you know, things to me about my nose. And because they did that, I become very conscious about my nose. And it took me some time in my adulthood to relax about those images. Well, here's the thing about...
Is it completely gone now, though, for you?
Yes. I mean, you know, it is. And I have to tell you that the reason it is I've come to the point, I mean, we'll just tie this into spirituality, I've come to the point that, you know, this is how I'm created. What on earth would I want to hold this creation in disdain for? I mean, what sense does that make? All that I am is a gift. And all that I do with that gift is the only way I have of repaying the giver. So to view myself in, I mean, you know, we age. And you know, part of that for me is losing my hair. Yeah, I have to tell, this is kind of a funny story. The other day, my older boy, who's at the University of Washington right now in the Honors College, was home, and he was in the back of my Escalade riding behind me, and he said to his mother, very, you know, out of nowhere, "Mom, has your dad got a lot of hair?" Now, his mother's father passed away before my son was born, and my wife said, "Yeah, why?" "Just curious," he said. Well, what he was talking about,
he was about
sitting
himself.
Right behind me, and he's looking at this classical male pattern baldness, knowing that it comes through the mother's side, and he's thinking, "Man, I hope I don't end up looking like that." But, you know, when you can see it for what it is, and you realize this is a natural process, this is the process that you were created through, you do see it with humor. You're not offended by it. You're not affronted by it. And part of that is how we approach our beliefs again. If we see with our beliefs ourselves with flaws, well, then as a flawed human being, we are less deserving. And we begin to put these self-imposed boundaries on everything that we will experience in our life. We will settle for less because... well, we're unattractive, or we're not deserving, or we're not as smart as somebody else, or we, you know, I mean, we can get right down to where people just say, "Well, he was born with a golden spoon in his mouth," you know. We find ways to rationalize our existence. And when somebody does that, I think of that as a subtraction game. A lot of people believe that, and I'm not saying they consciously believe this because they just haven't examined it, but they act it out, and they will recognize that as I tell you what they do. They subtract the quality of another human being in their efforts to exert their own quality. So, well, you know, so-and-so is not very smart, or that was really stupid of a dumb person to say, and they're just a dumb person. Or you hear kids all the time talking that way, but adults talk that way too. They talk about our leaders that way. And the fact of the matter is, maybe you disagree with political policy, but to talk about the person as though the person is stupid or dumb or ignorant or evil, that's a subtraction game that's really subtracting from you. It's a tell that says you don't find yourself worthy enough to be able to recognize the characteristics in this person that gave them the power in the first place. And then to remark in an intelligent way, well, you know, I disagree with that, and this is the reason I would disagree, without ever laying some personal attack on the other individual. These are the kinds of subtle beliefs that literally can, you know, they dictate how we navigate life. And the result of all this kind of thing is that we find ourselves often dissonant. We're driven in two different directions simultaneously. We're holding two mutually exclusive beliefs, and we're unaware of it. Flashback, ergo, I want to make $1 million, but I want to punish those folks that have $1 million. You know, I want to take 50, 60% of their income by way of taxes. At least I want to do that until I have $1 million. Then wait a minute, I don't want that to happen to me at all. You see, we honestly can find ourselves holding the silliest of ideas. I mean, just about everybody, you know, has heard this one, but it is still so common and true, and we see it every day. Someone has heard that it is more difficult for a rich man to get into heaven than for the laden camel to pass through the eye of the needle. And the eye of the needle was a gate in Bethlehem where camels, literally, if they were loaded, had to go through that gate on their knees. Well, you know, and so what they do is they have this belief that money is evil. And at the same time, they're not aware that they're really holding this belief that money is evil. And they're out trying to be successful in the world. And so as they get close to maybe making an adventure, some venture that they've taken on work, or maybe get a promotion, they push themselves away from it unconsciously. In fact, we should talk about those defense strategies that are developed as a result of our whole enculturation process and this mediocrity that we live in, and how those defense strategies are augmented to give rise to behavior that is self-sabotaging, self-destructive for each and every one of us. And it happens not as a result of even conscious knowledge. It happens as a result of our unconscious strategies.
When we come back, Eldon, I want to get your take on some tips in order to believe. And we're going to open up the phone lines now, give you an opportunity, one, to ask a question of Eldon Taylor about what we're talking about, I believe, and also perhaps share a story with us on how your belief system has affected you. We'll be back.